Our next guest on Downtown played the part of Margaret Houlihan for 11 seasons on one of the most iconic television series in history, MASH. Multiple Emmy Awards for that performance. She's also been helping animals for decades through her charity, the Sweetheart Animal Alliance. She's got a new book that showcases some of her wonderful watercolors of animals. And this weekend, she receives the Icon Award at the Oscars party. We had a wonderful time talking recently with actress Loretta Swit. A lot of very exciting things going on for you, including heading out to the coast this weekend to receive a wonderful honor at the Oscar viewing party this weekend, as you'll be a recipient of the Icon Award, along with Bernie Capel and another friend of our show, the wonderful Michael Learned.
Oh, yes. it couldn't be better. What a swell bunch. I mean, and also Jamie Farr has agreed to present me my award. That couldn't be better. I mean, he's such a sweetheart. And in fact, I did not invite him to do that. I don't like to impose on my MASH family. You know, they're always there for me. They're always doing things and so on. And I thought, this is, you know, not a small thing. You're asking him to come from far, put on a monkey suit, as we used to call them, and you know, have dinner and do thing and the stuff. That's fun, but it's, you know, and so I said, don't anybody bother my family. Well, of course, they did. they called them all, you know. And so I said that to Jamie. I said, just melted my heart that you said yes and, you know, you want to do this. And he's, oh, swear, are you kidding? I love you. So that's fun. Bernie Capel and I did a wonderful love boat together that we still talk about. It was just so much fun and so nice. And Michael Learned, I absolutely adore. I think she's one of the best actresses ever. So this is going to be a happy time. It's going to be a wonderful, happy time.
Also, a brand new book out that showcases your wonderful watercolor artwork and all for a wonderful cause, too, the Sweetheart Animal Alliance.
Uh-huh. Thank you. I'm glad you like it. I love painting. So how wonderful is that? I'm doing something to raise money for my charity and help animals. And at the same time, I'm loving painting. And so I'm in a win-win situation here.
I actually had one of our state legislators reach out when he saw that you were going to be on our show and said, I remember when she came to Maine about 15 years ago and testified before the legislature when we were discussing animal rights, and they remember that very vividly.
Oh, how wonderful. Thank you. I may have been with Betty White. Betty White and I used to go out and raise a ruckus over animal rights, and did he say what the issue was?
He didn't. No. His memory didn't go back that far. You know, you get to be like me in your early 60s, and the memory goes.
Yeah, that's kind of not true. But if you want to believe that, it's up to you. It's kind of not true. Your memory, you know, you just keep exercising your mind and your memory. It never has to leave you. By the same token, you can meet some young people who can't remember their phone number. It's not genetic. It's not, you can develop. There have been studies on how to teach memory, and that work. And there are people, and I forget what you call this group of people who remember every day from the time they were born. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Well, I know Mary Lou Henner is one of those people.
Right. Yes. And there's a name. They have a name for it. There are a few, obviously not a lot. But, yes, Mary Lou can remember everything from the time she was born. This is phenomenal. Your memory and your mind is your biggest asset. So don't think that you're just repeating things that you've heard, that people start forgetting things. It's bull. It's not true. You can remember. You can train yourself to remember and just not get lazy about it.
No question about that.
I don't want to pressure you into anything, but I'm serious. You know, What did you say, 60? That's very young.
We had a guest on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about ways to improve your memory as you age, and they had a little test that you took, and one of the giveaways was, do you make lists all the time? And I thought, well, I do that, but that's not a sign of aging. Uh-huh. I've been doing that for about 35 years to keep myself organized.
Exactly. I was about to say you're organizational. That's a good sign. You're a thinking man. Oh no, that's not a sign of I can't forget. Or it's a sign of an organized mind.
Well, when you talk about memories, so many of us had wonderful memories brought back recently with Alan Alda's Clear and Vivid podcast. Oh, well, we had Sarah Chase on our show, one of Alan's producers, to preview the podcast, and she had some wonderful stories. But how great it was to hear you all together again, and it just came through the love and affection that y'all have for each other.
Yes, and what happens is that globally, you know, the families watching us had love and affection for each other and for us as they were consuming the series. We all became family. I'm theorizing, but I honestly feel that people want to know us better. They love us. They love our characters. They love what the show represented, and they don't want to let it go. And they want us to be our family. They want us to be close. And Alan and I have had the most remarkable response. You know, we're on Twitter, you know, or whatever. And there are more than once we have gotten Alan wanting to turn this into a weekly series, you know, get the group together and entertain us. But the response to the podcast was just overwhelming. People had so much fun. I had a fan come up to me and say he plays it over and over just to make himself laugh. He says it is so entertaining and it makes me feel so good to like connect with you guys again. See, that's it. That's it. The connection. They don't ever want to lose that connection, and they feel they're connecting to something really solid, moral, spiritual, and healthy. And that's, again, Loretta's theorizing up a storm, but I honestly feel that that's how the audience feels about MASH and the characters.
Well, Mike Farrell is a great friend of our show. He comes on with us every year, and he's told us a number of times about what a unique experience it was for him when he joined the show a few years in, finding out that the producers and the writers actually wanted the input of the actors, and that's not something that always happens.
That's true. Absolutely true.
Also, what was incredible, and you talked about it on the podcast too, the transformation that your character made from Hot Lips Houlihan to Margaret and fleshing out that character. And I've read other interviews that was important to you to make sure that the character was fully formed.
Quite honestly, unless she continued to grow, I wouldn't have been able to stay, because it wouldn't be real. No human being, and I'm playing a human being. You change every minute, every day, you can't, and things happen to you. The war, we're at the front. That happens every day. Every day, we're in the OR, 14-hour stretches maybe. You cannot do that and not be affected by it, not change. It has to change you somewhat. Here is a woman too young to be a major. They promoted them in wartime very quickly. She had credentials, and she was a good student. She was a good nurse. So she got promoted, and I'm sure she was the youngest major. I don't know if Harker said that in his book, but my research says that, you know, they promoted them and moved them forward. The other thing that people need to know is that those women were volunteers. They weren't drafted.
Right.
They were volunteering to be in the country that was the hottest you could find in the summer and the coldest in the winter, and the three killers during the Korean conflict. Number one was frostbite. Number two was snake bite. Number three was the police action. So that's kind of interesting in itself, that the territory, the area, the surroundings were enemies for these women and men, but the women who, I just think they're heroes. You know, they volunteered to serve there, and it was not an easy, pleasant thing, and they did it anyway. But what's wonderful about the show is that you never stop forgetting that they were crazy because they were in a crazy situation. So they couldn't be sane. They, in order to survive, they had to be crazy. They had to pull pranks and make jokes and do crazy things and fall into each other's arms and looking for companionship, solace, just humanity. Humanity searching for something humane in a horribly inhumane situation. War is inhumane. War is not human. It's not civilized. It's wrong. And so that was always the undercurrent, and that's what worked better than the early movies years ago, you know, where you, let's take this hill or the charge of the Light Brigade. You know, Kwai, Bill Holden's character, for example, very, very wonderfully expressed his feelings about soldiering and war and military and, you know, he had talking about the general. He says that kind of heroism gets people killed. You know, so he was very much against what he was doing. And then, of course, to find out during the film that he was imitating an officer because he thought they'd be treated better. He was so human. He was so human, and in the end, got rather a heroic death trying to blow up the bridge.
Right.
So, but that was as close to truth and real as you can get. And I think MASH did that. People died on our show, and McLean Stevens had this beautiful little advice for Hawkeye. He said there are two things, two rules of war. One, people die. Two, doctors can't change rule number one. And out of that came an episode called Sometimes You Hear the Bullet.
Right.
And it was an old chum, an old school chum of Hawkeye's,
right,
brought in on a stretcher. And so the writers and the producers, they really tried to deal with very real, honest situations. A lot of our stuff came from people who had been in Korea or had been treated at MASH units, or, you know, I mean, the stories came from truth. Even like the funny ones, the soldier wanted a, I don't know the Latin name for it, but it's a nose job. And you can't perform plastic surgery like that. But they did it anyway. Do you know what I mean? It was so real. It was so, so delicious. And, they're just the things that they were trying to always deal with. The boys with their martinis and the still in the slump, they finally came around to saying they're always drunk. They can't be. They have to start seeing it's going to affect their work. It's going to affect their whatever. And so, we sure, out of that came an episode called Alcoholics Unanimous. So,
right.
So, and you had Hawkeye and Trapper and me and, you know, the people who were drinking, deal with that, get on top of it, and realize it wasn't going to help.
One of the things that really stands out to me, and we've talked with Mike about this before too, is it says a lot about the cast that you were able to bring in new people when original cast members left, whether it was Mike Farrell or Harry Morgan or David Ogden Stiers, and they immediately meshed with the rest of you and came out of that experience loving it every bit as much as the folks who've been there from day one.
Right. The folks that had been there from day one left in year three. So the first day we all met was magic. I mean, everybody loved everybody. It was real cold. We were out at the ranch. I remember Wayne was blue, and he was so cold, and his nose was dripping and freezing. He had like a little icicle on his nose. I mean, it was just unbelievable. It was 5 a.m. He's standing there shivering in a Hawaiian shirt. And so we were all cuddling. And I do believe the body temperatures and the cuddling made it impossible for us not to get close to each other. And but there was, I think, the magic of the stories and what we were doing that really nailed the bonding in a special way when you're working on something that eventually gets the Humanitas Award. I mean, when you're working on that kind of level where the writers are just so outstanding, you got to have the words. I mean, I'm not saying the actors weren't wonderful. We were. But you got to have the words. You don't do that on your own. Nothing, actually, in anything is achieved by one person or one group. It's a real communal effort. And we had that. So while you're complimenting us taking in the new people, you have to realize the new people were magnificent. It was not a chore to get to know these. I mean, Mike is like my big brother. He'll say, "Let my little sis" or something, or I'll say, "Hey, bro, come over here, give us a hug," or I don't know. He really has filled that part for me like a big brother. And Harry was everything, not only to me. Harry was everything to everybody. If you gathered the troupe and said, "All right, just one actor, who's your favorite?" Everybody would say Harry. Harry was, there was nobody like Harry.
That scene where you said goodbye to him, even now, I can't think about it without tearing up.
How do you think I felt? We did more than one take because I remember Burt Metcalf was directing. And he was looking to heaven and saying, "Please, people, stop crying." it was so magical and wonderful and bittersweet, very painful. I mean, when I look at that, yes, it's acting because you are using yourself totally, and it's a method kind of actor that does that. But to look at Harry and have to say, "You dear sweet man, I'll never forget you." I mean, that was in my heart everlastingly before I had to shoot it, when I met him. He was a guest star. I fell in love with him then. But I'd always loved his work in film and TV and so forth. But here was this prince of a guy. I mean, he was everything to everybody. He was my confessor, my father, my lunch date. He was just... And the best colleague. He was a serious actor and took himself so seriously, but never so seriously that he didn't make light of a situation. He didn't gag. He didn't pun. He was everything. He was everything. And he would just destroy us, make us laugh so hard. There was just nobody like Harry. Modest. And I said to him, "I really would love for you to start writing your book. I mean, think, you've done something like, 110 films, most of them classics." I started to reel off Inherit the Wind,
Oxbow Incident, yeah.
And so he started to laugh. He said, "But Lorette, you're not naming any of the turkeys." He said, of which there were many. He said, "I did a film with Bobby Blake called The Most Dangerous Man in the West, starring Vaughn Monroe." Now that's funny. He said, "Vaughn Monroe racing with the moon," and then Harry was off with his funny stories. He was special. Nobody like Harry. I used to say, "You are half gremlin, leprechaun, Menahuni." He just was special. Everybody could. You could always go to Harry with a problem, or I don't know. He was always there.
I understand there's a wonderful story about the final episode and a little bit of an inside joke here of sorts with David Ogden Stiers, who had borrowed a book of poetry from Margaret, and that when he handed it back.
No, vice versa. Margaret borrowed it from him.
Oh, that's right.
And she thought it was a gift that he should give her, very Margaret. And he said, well, no, it's mine, and I want it back. And there are like earlier scenes that are run along this line. And during Goodbye, Farewell, and Amen, he came to collect. Now, prior to this time, you have to know that I always had a running gag with Dave, and I teased him all the time about nobody knew where he lived, where to find him. We had to call his agent if we want to invite him to a party, you know. And I said, you're not going to get away with that with this gang. We're close. We love you. You love us. You know, you can't give me your phone number at least, you know. And I said, all right, David, what if I wanted to invite you to a party? And he said, I probably wouldn't want to come. You know, Harry Winchester. You know, so I probably wouldn't have any desire to attend such a party. Anyway, so this went on a long time. And when Winchester, in saying goodbye, gives her the poetry, the book of poems, he handed the book to me on camera. It was my close-up. And Margaret opens the book because Winchester has signed it. And David signed it to Loretta, which I saw on camera, which is why I nearly avalanched with tears. And it had his phone number.
Yeah.
He wrote his phone number. I just, you know, and then unrehearsed, when I pull away with the Jeep, he looked at me and he put his hand over his heart. And that spoke volumes.
Well, it was so wonderful to hear you all together again and sharing those great memories and some very funny stories.
Yeah.
There was some practical joking going on there. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Wish we had been able to do this when Bill was still with us, David, and, you know, just you would have found out how very funny Harry could be. Oh, my. I remember once Harry did a funny little gesture sometimes that particularly made Mike crazy. He would just roar. He would just fall on the floor and laugh. So there was this one episode where the boys were trying to get away with something, and they want to quarantine this soldier. And Margaret rolls into the office saying, sir, they're trying to pull a fast one. I don't know what it is. And so, all right, he says, boys, fess up, what's going on? And they're in cahoots, and they say, we think the patient has schistosomiasis. And I'm like, what? Harry calms me down and says, no, there is, I am familiar with schistosomiasis. However, he said, it's acquired from wading waist deep in the Nile. And so he looks at the boys and he said, but I don't understand how a soldier in Korea, a fair distance from Egypt, could acquire such a disease. Now, when he said wading into the Nile, every rehearsal, he would do this funny little gesture. It was sort of uphill, like the soldier was wading uphill. Well, Mike could take just so much of it. He finally just fell on the floor, and he just could not. He was in pain. He was holding his stomach and screaming. So Harry used to do that to us a lot. And I can't tell you how wonderful that is to do the kind of work we did, which was very serious. It's very serious subjects. And yet we were able to laugh and enjoy each other so deeply. And you see the similarity is very, very amazing, because that's what the characters were also doing. they were doing a very serious job in a very serious situation.
I wanted to pass along a personal story here. My sister recently retired as a state policeman in New York State, and she said, well, if you get a chance, mention this, that in the days after 9/11, there was a gathering of first responders, and she was there at the Javits Center in New York, and you came putting yourself in harm's way and talked to them and thanked them for all their efforts, and she told me she remembers to this day how impressed and how grateful all of those first responders were to have you come and make the time and say hello and thank them for their efforts.
Oh, wow. Well, that's so beautiful. I was at Ground Zero. I had gas mask and everything. I was there when they were still pulling down buildings. And it was important for the guys to know that everybody cared. I mean, they're supposed to be there. They're supposed to be doing what they're doing and so forth and so on. Case in point, I was at the Javits Center one day feeding people, and this fireman came around in front of me. There was a line of people going through. I was making burgers or something. And he said, "Miss Witt, you were here yesterday." I couldn't believe he said that. I looked at him. I said, "That's right. So were you." And it was, he looked at me like, "Right, we're both here together." And that was, I'll never forget that moment. It didn't occur to him that he was coming every day. He was surprised that I was there again. And that told me I was doing the right thing, you know, certainly. And another time, I was working at one of the wagons with the food. One of the workers came over to me and they said, "Could you go I'll take you to part of the line." One of the guys was asking if you were here today. So I knew it was meaningful to all of us, actually, but it was meaningful to them because they started to ask if I was there or was I coming later or tomorrow or something. And but these guys and these wonderful search rescue dogs, search rescue people, I could literally leave the Javits Center midnight, whatever, 1 o'clock in the morning, and hail a black and white as if it were a taxi. They would pull over and I would get in the car and they'd take me home. And same thing for a fireman or any of us. There were no strangers. It was Shangri-La. Everybody was connected. Everybody was family. It's horrible that it takes thousands of people to die to make us realize that we're all connected.
Well, it made an impact, and certainly. My sister remembers it very well all these years later.
Yes. Tell her the memory is very vivid in my heart also. Every day that I was there, I was there for about 2 months. I had a job, and I had to go out of town for it, but it was a very important part of my heart and my life, my memory. Never forget being with all those extraordinary people. I had the most charming experience. I'm not sure I can tell you about it. I'm not sure it's... I mean, it's not crazy, but I was with a bunch of guys. We finally sat down. This is at Ground Zero. We all said, "The hell with this," and we took off our masks. And they're like soldiers. They can do it. They're like, but I thought, "The hell with this. They should know who's behind this mask." And so we sat in and without our masks, probably inhaling who knows what, and they chatting and said, "I didn't know you lived in New York. You live in New York now?" And I said, "Well, I was here doing a play." And they said, "Which play?" And I thought, here we go. I was in town doing the vagina monologues. Now, you're already laughing. Prior to how serious they took the play eventually, the press had, when you did interviews and and I was noted for saying, just a moment, I'm not gonna let you make fun of this. It's a serious piece. You should be taking it seriously. These are women speaking out, blah, blah, blah. And I would do this thing. And all my interviews were like that. If they chuckled, I'd say, hold it. Because if that's where this interview is going, I'm out of here or whatever. So I was very adamant about that. I believed in the piece. Now, I'm sitting here with these boys, young men. And he said, what play are you doing? And I said, the vagina monologues. And they didn't seem to have heard of the play, but one of them looked at me and said, man, I really could use one of them monologues right now. And I laughed. I mean, we screamed, we howled. It was so beautiful and open. And, it was, to me, he was saying, boy, I'd like to hold and hug and love a woman right now. I didn't find it predation. I didn't find it low or dirty or he wasn't chuckling at the idea. I mean, it was just fabulous. It was just a wonderful, funny moment. I told the story to Alan, and he was screaming. He said, that is so funny. But it was wonderful. It was so honest and pure, and I'll never forget it.
If Eve Ensler only knew.
Yes.
That's a wonderful story.
You said it was your sister who
yes.
remembered all of these things?
Absolutely.
Well, please give her my love. Tell her thank you for being there. Thank her from me for being there. We did a great thing for us to be there.
Loretta, thank you so much. Appreciate you making time for us. Travel safely and congratulations again on the award.
Oh, thanks. God bless. Enjoy the rest of your night.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Bye for now.